Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with my guest, David Bryant Copeland, author of the upcoming book, Sustainable Web Development with Ruby on Rails. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So Dave, I've come across you on the internet a number of times over the years, and you and I were actually talking pre-show how we had one conversation maybe like 5 years ago, because you and I both wrote a book on Angular. Yeah. But maybe you could tell us just a little bit about the books you've written in the past. I think the first one I came across was something about how to be a senior engineer or something like that. So what have you done book-wise?
Yeah, totally. So I wrote a book about writing command line apps in Ruby because I grew up on the command line and, you know, I'm very comfortable with Unix and use VI. And so that was a fun experience. I then wrote the book you were just talking about, The Senior Software Engineer. It was basically based on my experience, like working at Living Social and seeing how to be effective as an engineer without being told what to do. I self-published that, and I still sell some copies of that, so that provides me a nice dinner every once in a while.
Nice.
And then I wrote a few more for the Pragmatic Programmers. So I did the book you mentioned on Rails and Angular. I'm the co-author of their Rails book, Agile Web Development with Rails, which is mostly just updating it for the new version of Rails. So it's not a ton of stuff. And then I decided to sort of capture my experience doing Rails at Stitch Fix over quite a long time with quite a lot of people, and that's what this book is about. So,
okay,
yeah,
yeah, and I think we might actually know some of the same people from Living Social. I didn't work there, but I know a handful of people who did. I think Mike Pence worked there. If that rings any bells,
familiar.
There's, I mean, a lot he's of also names the that vice president of the United States. Shares a name with him, but yeah,
yeah.
And then, yeah. I don't know who else, but okay. So, what is this new book about? I mean, there's kind of a description on the website, sustainable-rails.com, but what? What led you to have the idea for this book?
Yeah, so at Stitch Fix, right, I was a very early engineer, so I was the third engineer hired. We had almost no code then. And so you fast forward the 6.5 years I was there, it's still mostly Rails, and it's not like a Rails monolith. There's a Rails microservices ecosystem there. There's Rails apps that are 5+ years old that are still running, that still work and still do their thing. And so I got to sort of have some input into how that happens and see the effects of some of those decisions. Like, some of them were good and some of them were bad. And it was just like an experience I don't think a lot of people get. And so I wanted to see if I could kind of capture that, because I think there's a lot of, it's easy to make very short term decisions that are not good for the long term and vice versa. Right. So I was trying to see if I could just sort of capture that experience as a set of, like, here's how to deal with each part of Rails in a way that is sustainable, right? Not like scalable, because scalable is such a, like, a weird word. Like, everybody thinks it means like fast, but like, it's really sustainable. Can we keep working on this app after a year, 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a topic that's particularly interesting to me. I've worked on a lot of different code bases. I added up like all the different jobs and consulting gigs I've had, and it's like 35 or 40 or like that. And honestly, the vast majority of the code bases I've worked with were pretty nasty and pretty difficult to work with. And that's kind of the norm. And some people blame Rails for that. And some of that criticism is justified, but I think most of it's not. I think that's just kind of, it's really hard to build an application in such a way that you can maintain productivity over a long period of time.
Yeah.
I'm now getting to the point in a project I'm working on where for the first year and a half, things were pretty easy. I knew how to keep it clean and organized. Now it's getting to the point where it's not so easy. I don't have all the skills to keep it as clean as I would like. And in fact, I was working on an area of the code earlier today that I knew was not very good when I worked on it. I just didn't know how to make it better. And now I'm coming back and I'm like, what does this even do? And so that's a really big challenge.
Yeah, I had experienced the horrible Rails monolith, but in Java, right? I did a big Java project before I worked at Living Social, and you know, it started off clean and then it just got messy because it was just not sort of managed, and it's hard to manage, right? So yeah, I don't know. I think, like, you know, it's kind of silly to say like writing simple code is like the first step to all this, but every fancy thing I did, every clever functional programming, implicit blah blah blah, it was just such a pain when I had to come back and change it, or when someone else had to change it, I felt sorry for them and I apologized for making a mess for them for no good reason.
Yeah. So here's a common problem that I've come across as Rails applications grow. And I wonder how you've experienced this and dealt with it. So the active record pattern is a great pattern when you're getting started, and then it becomes kind of less great over time in my experience. And I want to say, in case anybody's listening who's not aware of this, active record was not like a Rails invention. It's a design pattern. If you look in the book, Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture by Martin Fowler, you can find that design pattern in there. And I understand the way that came about is like DHH read that book and used that idea inside of Rails. So that pattern works great when you're just starting out, but then as things grow and you end up with like models that are 1,000 lines long and stuff like that, it's not so great anymore. I'm sure you've experienced the same thing.
Oh yeah. The user model at Living Social, the first, I would say 50 lines were just includes of other modules that had other methods in them, and then the whole thing was thousands of lines long.
The first 50 lines were includes of other modules.
It was intense.
Wow.
Yeah, and so myself and another engineer early at Stitch Fix, he had a similar experience at ModCloth, and we were like, we're not doing that again. So basically, what we did is we just said no business logic in the active records at all. Like, the active records are great for like getting the database and accessing data in the database and saving it, and even validations, right, are really nice, but methods to do things like those just go somewhere else, because like it's just too hard. It's too hard to know like where should they go, and you end up having like at Stitch Fix, like shipment was like the god concept, right? Everything was on a shipment, and if we had followed this pattern, we would have had hundreds of methods in shipment, and it would have been a nightmare to work in. So we just said no, just don't do that, and it worked out pretty well. Like even now, that's how it is.
So how does that go? Because I've done similar things. I've taken a similar approach right from the beginning, actually, with this project, where I try as much as possible to take methods out of the active record classes and put them in different objects. Often they are like more fine-grained objects. Like, I'm trying to think of an example, but I can't. But the issue that I have is like, okay, I have, for example, an appointment class, an appointment active record model. There's definitely stuff in that appointment model that can be like, I use the term, I don't know if anybody else uses this term, but I use the term hidden abstraction. So sometimes I look at a big long model and I see like a clump of like five methods, and I say, all these five methods kind of have some level of cohesion to them. They're kind of about the same stuff. And maybe there's a hidden abstraction in here of like something that doesn't even have a name yet, but the concept is there just waiting to be like named and then have that extracted out into a different class. So I definitely do that. But the thing that's tough is like, I still have an appointment concept that I would love to be independent of this appointment active record model, but like it feels weird to have another class called appointment, and now I have two of them, and one inherits from active record and one doesn't. So how do you handle all that
stuff? So there's kind of two problems you have to solve to like not put this stuff in the active record. Like the first is like what I call a derived field. So like the classic thing is you've got a first name and a last name, and you need to show like full name. So you'll add def full name, your first name plus space plus last name. So like all of those things, like they have to go somewhere else, usually like some sort of presenter or whatever you want to call it. So like the controllers might say, all right, I've got to present an account, but all I have is like a user and an order history. So I'm going to grab those and use them to make an account, and that's going to like display. That's usually pretty easy to just decide to do. The harder thing is the do it methods, right? The business logic, like the workflow. Like I think Noel Rappin, who has written a few books, calls them workflows. And we call them the service objects. So basically when you look at like one of these Rails apps, it's Stitch Fix, there's app services has a whole bunch of like, you know, return processor. And you go into the return processor class and there's a method called process return. And it takes like a shipment and then it just has all the logic for processing a return in it. And it doesn't feel very OO at all. It feels very like procedural, but like it's pretty easy to do, and it works. And then when you write a test for that, and you know, you got your like five tests for this one method, and you know, it's pretty simple, but it's just not OO at all. And I think I'm okay with that.
Interesting. I recently wrote this big blog post about how I loathe what people refer to as service objects. So this might lead to an interesting discussion you and I can have about this. But first I want to ask you about a different thing you mentioned that I didn't completely understand, which is when you're talking about presenters. So that's not something that I've really done. I'm familiar to an extent with decorators. I'm not really clear on the difference between decorators and presenters, if it's just a terminology thing or if they're actually two different things. Is that something you can speak to at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think the general concept is I need to run some logic on my database column so that I can display things in the right way, right? Like making a full name or, you know, turning a number of cents into like $1.24, you know, those sorts of things. And it's common, a way is to just put those methods on the active record and, right, then you just have this growing list of like presentation concerns on your active record. So the other thing is to like make some class that does that. So like, I think they're all roughly the same, but like one technique is what I call a presenter, which is a new object. Maybe it's like an active model, and that it all it does is has these this logic for formatting stuff for the view. Some people call it view models. Then they're like a decorator. I guess you could think of decorators as like I'm going to add a bunch of mix-ins to an active record only for the view, and they're going to, you know, it's all kind of the same concept, and I have opinions about which way to do what, but the gist is your view formatting is like in a separate thing from your active record, so you can keep those kind of separate.
Yeah. I've implemented some decorators in my Rails project that I'm working on now, and I use the Draper gem.
Yeah.
And I had some difficulties, and I like got frustrated with Draper because I decided to just like write my own poro, plain old Ruby object as a decorator, but then that didn't work out great either. And so I'm like, okay, let me go back to the source. And so I read the part of, hang on a second. Oh, I have the book on my shelf. I forgot what it's called. It's that design patterns book, the Gang of Four thing, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I read at least part of the decorator chapter. And it turns out that in my understanding, the Draper gem is actually pretty faithful to what it says in that book. And basically the idea, to use Ruby terminology, is the decorator is like a mix-in. It's transparent, not transparent, it's not transparent to the client of the object that the decorator has been applied to that object.
Yeah, that gets really confusing when it's like, okay, I've got a customer, but is it a customer or is it a customer presenter or is it a customer with these magic methods mixed in? I personally find that very confusing when I'm trying to figure out like what is supposed to happen in some code. So a pattern that we did, again, it's really stupid and simple and not very OO, is like, we'd have like a plain old Ruby object that just had a bunch of adder readers of all the attributes. And then there'd be like a factory method on that thing that's like, you know, from shipment, and it would take the active records, and then it would have this big line of code to just basically have all the logic of converting the values. And then you could write a test for that to make sure that it was working the way you thought. And that test was nice because it was just operating on objects and you don't have to deal with the view. And it's gross. Like, I don't know. It was simple. And you could know what you had, right? And I don't know.
So the object that you were using in the view was not, in this example, it wasn't a shipment object. It was one of these shipment presenter objects. And then you could do like shipment presenter dot shipment if you wanted to refer to the shipment itself. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I mean, we didn't usually expose the active record directly like that. I mean, sometimes you could do it. You could like delegate like any method, I don't know, to send it to the shipment. But usually we would just have the shipment presenter just define every single like attribute that it needed in the view. And then those methods would either dig into the shipment to get the right value, or we would initialize them in some sort of factory method. So, but yeah, you always knew what you had, and you could always easily trace back like how it got created.
Yeah, I like that. I've been using something recently called a facade object, which I just learned about maybe a year ago, which is, well, let me describe the problem I had. I had this like download functionality, this certain download functionality where you could like queue up a list of things and then download everything in that queue and clear the queue. And I had that same behavior in like three different places in my application. And I had a controller concern that would add a few like instance variables to the controller that would then trickle down to the view. When I wrote it, it seemed fine. But then I came back like several months later and I realized it was actually really confusing the way the instance variables came through, because it's like, wait a second, did this instance variable come from this concern? Which variables come through? It wasn't really clear where the line was between what was part of that shared behavior and what wasn't. So I created a facade object instead, where instead of my concern setting like three different instance variables, it only set one, and then everything I needed came from that one.
Yeah, we did a lot of that. We had the idea that the controller method should just expose one IVAR that would have everything you needed, and if an active record didn't have it, then you'd make a presenter or whatever. But then,
wait, sorry, IVAR, what's that?
Oh, it's an instance variable.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people call them IVAR. Yeah. So there was only ever one, and that was the thing that was exposed, exactly like what you said. And that, right, because it's always a struggle with Ruby to figure out like where stuff comes from, especially if you start using modules and mixins and delegators and all those fancy things. So I like to sort of say, let's just try to make it really clear where stuff actually comes from so we can quickly figure out how it works.
Yeah, I've been a really big fan of that lately. But what I don't understand now is, before I was kind of confused about the difference between presenters and decorators, and I still don't understand, and now facades. I don't understand the difference between presenter, decorator, and facade.
They're all kind of similar. I mean, so this is a thing that we didn't do a good job at, is there were many different patterns in place in an app. Like, sometimes you could call them different names, but they're basically different ways to do the same thing. And that can get tiring because it's nice to just have one way to do things. So then, you know, you see two ways to do things. And so inevitably somebody will make a third way to do it. And, you know, that gets confusing too.
Yeah. So you're no longer still with Stitch Fix, right?
Yep.
How many developers did they have like at the time you left?
I think it was around 200.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah,
it can even be difficult when you have like 10 developers to get everybody doing things kind of in alignment. I remember I had this job like 12 years ago where I would be working on a client project and I would implement a certain thing in a certain way, and then I would get in trouble because there was like a standard way I was supposed to do it, apparently. But there was no way for me to know, because it was a development agency. And so it's not like I could look to other places in that same project. I guess I would have had to like look at all of our past projects for finding that, or like go around and ask everybody like, hey, have you ever done this before? So that was kind of dumb. What I think would probably have been good is if we had some kind of internal documentation that said, if you have this kind of situation, this is how you should handle it. Did you have anything like that at Stitch Fix, or how did you deal with that issue?
Yeah. I mean, initially it was, you know, follow the code that you're editing, and that worked because the code existed, and if you were making a new app, you usually were someone who already knew the kind of implicit convention, so you would just, you know, do that. And we had an app generator that would like make you an app in the Stitch Fix way. But then as we got more developers, like you get into the like the 30 or 50 developers, and there's a lot of what you just described. Like pull request comes in, you're like, no, you really need to do it this way, this way, this way. And then they're like, well, how was I supposed to know that? So we started having documentation, but that is another problem. So where you've got all the documentation, but nobody knows where it is or how to find it or what the word is to look up.
Yeah.
So then you're like, well, here's a document that you were pointed out on your first day and totally forgot about. But yeah, that's hard. We had the most success when stuff was just done automatically, like when either a script would generate the thing or a gem would be installed to set a thing up so that you didn't have to like read docs. It would just sort of happen. But that's hard to do for things like service objects and presenter patterns.
That's more like code review
and that sort of thing.
Something I've been enjoying recently is custom generators.
Yeah.
Did you do any stuff with that by chance?
Yeah, we did the, so we have an application generator that does a lot of that. And then we have a gem that like, so a lot of our Rails apps are like, you know, quote unquote microservices. So there's a bunch, not a bunch, but there's a fair number of things that need to be sort of configured, those to be a service in the Stitch Fix way. So we have a gem that you install that gem and then you run a generator and it will like, you know, insert a bunch of stuff. A couple other internal gems would do that. So I found it really handy because then you don't have to document what to do. You just say, run this thing. And if you want to know what it does, cool, here's the code. If you don't care, then just run it and it will do the right thing. So that's handy. I like that a lot.
Yeah, we had that same issue you described about the documentation at the last place I worked. Our original problem was that we didn't have any documentation. And we got better about that. We were writing things down. And then the problem was that, okay, we have now a lot of documentation, but it's completely disorganized and nobody knows how to find anything. So yeah, just having it obviously is not enough. It has to be like structured in some way. And we didn't have that part figured out by the time I left that organization. But it seems like it could make sense to have something like, you know, open source projects like Rails obviously are pretty successful with their documentation. It seems like a company should probably model off of something like that.
Yeah, there was a there's always a lot of debate about how to solve that problem. And I think it's just really hard, especially when like, you know, there's thousands of Rails developers, so they can't just talk to each other and figure it out. But like 100 developers can eventually talk to each other and figure things out, and it sucks, but it works. So it's like not quite enough friction to solve it. I don't know. I think it's a hard problem for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is. My untested hypothesis is that the right thing to do is put one single person in charge of all the documentation, and then it's their job. Because when it's everybody's job, it's like nobody's job.
Nobody, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, totally. That was an oft-suggested solution by several engineers. And I was never in the position to make decisions about spending the company's money, but those who were did not like that solution, so that was never enacted. So,
yeah. Yeah, documentation, it's difficult. Okay, so maybe let's talk about service objects again.
Yeah.
So I like wrote this big rant about service objects, but a big part of my rant is like, the term service objects is really like ill-defined because different people use that term to mean different things.
Yep.
And so my experience is that service object is a term that a lot of people use to just refer to anything that doesn't inherit from Active Record is automatically a service object. And I don't think that's a very useful way of framing things. And I imagine that your way of defining that's a little different. So what does service object mean in your usage?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I think about it is calling it an object is weird. So it's a class who has code, and the code is there to sort of implement some sort of process that needs to happen. So something more than just take these form fields and save them to the database, but like, okay, I've got to save this, but if this is this, then we have to send this email. But if this is the case, then we have to write this other record, like whatever that logic is, that's in some method in some service objects. And so basically it's, you know, takes in some arguments, probably some active records, and says, I want to do this process on these active records. It does it. And then it returns some sort of result that says kind of what happens. And it's pretty like quote unquote functional. Like it doesn't have a lot of internal state. It just sort of like does some logic basically.
And how big would one of these things tend to be when you did it?
They're pretty small. Mostly they have one method, maybe two, if there's two things that are tightly related, and maybe need to share a private method or something. And then the contents of those methods, I mean, they can be any, you know, a few lines of code. Some of them can be quite long if the process that they need to implement is complicated. And that's the thing that was, it's hard to deal with, because if you've got something that's like just necessarily complicated, like I've mentioned processing return at Stitch Fix is complicated. So if you make lots of little tiny classes with little tiny methods, then you've spread this complexity over a whole bunch of different locations. So it's hard to get a view of it. So you tend to have like one method with like 30 lines of code, which is gross, but it is the entirety of this complicated thing. So,
You know, I discover every few years that I've never understood object-oriented programming, but now I do. And then a few years later, I have the same thought. When I was first starting out, I thought the like key of object-oriented programming is like, oh, okay, I have this patient class. That means that everything related to a patient goes in this patient class. And so then I would end up with a class, just like we were talking about near the beginning, where you would have dozens, if not more, of methods. And that's bad, because like in your like processing a return example, let's say obviously patient doesn't fit into that domain model, but let's say a customer or something like that.
Yeah.
You could conceivably have a method on the customer class that has something to do with processing a return. And the old me would have thought that that makes sense. But what I realize now is when you have that structure or whatever, where the return logic is spread across all these different classes, that's not good, because that's really hard to understand.
Yeah, totally. Well, and the realization for me was like, so I came to OO from C, and so the OO was sold to me as like, oh, it's like you can have a struct, but you can make the contents of the struct private, so that these methods, they're the only things that have access to these like secret variables, so you can encapsulate, which makes a lot of sense. But like active records aren't encapsulated at all. Everything's public. So like, what's the point of putting the method on the active record? You don't get access to any magic. You could just call it on the active record itself. So there's no, I just don't see the benefit, because all the active record attributes are public anyway. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I were, well, it's hard to say, but if I were faced with needing to have a task of processing return, obviously like a person would need to be familiar with the details in order to say how they would do it. Maybe I'd be inclined to make some object structure that's like in a namespace related to returning a product or something like that. Or it may well be that I would do the exact same thing as you and have something procedural, because it's definitely not the case that procedural is never the right answer. Some things just are procedural, and so it makes sense to structure them that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice when the code matches the reality of what it's trying to model, because then you understand one thing and you're already pretty much there with understanding the other. But, you know, doesn't always work that way, but it works that way a lot, I think.
Yeah. Something I've heard people talk about that I've never achieved myself is like a total separation of the database interaction and domain modeling. It sounds like you've probably, your experience is more like mine, where there's always been some degree of a mixture. You didn't have them completely separated from one another.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if we, I don't think we really tried to do that, because the process is like we're writing to the database. I mean, that's what we're trying to do a lot of times. So it just makes it easier. You know, so where this gets tricky is when you move to microservices, and where you're like database, you write to the database and all of a sudden now it's a HTTP call to some other service that you don't control. And like, we did try to make it active record, like, right. Okay. So like shipment.save is going to call the save, you know, URL against the shipment service. And like, that is just, it just makes it very confusing, because you look at the code and you think you're writing to the database and you're actually doing something way more complicated than that. And you have to handle it way differently than writing to a database. So I don't know. I found it just ends up being easier when things just kind of are what they are and you're not hiding them, you know, just to hide them.
When did you reach the point at Stitch Fix when you started to sense that you maybe wanted to re-architect or whatever and transition to a microservices architecture?
Yeah, so initially what we did was instead of making like a monolithic app, we made a bunch of different apps that would share the monolithic database. So like there's the stitchfix.com app is separate from the warehouse management system app, even though they share the database.
Okay. Wait, sorry. Did you do that from the beginning or was this part of a change?
We did that from the beginning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we decided like we're not going to make a monolithic app and here's how we're going to do it because we knew microservices would be complicated. So that lasted us for a while. And then we started getting to a point where, you know, you start putting data in this monolithic database that like is only needed by like one tiny little thing. And it actually doesn't make sense to couple it there. And so that's when we started making like standalone services. And there's a lot of services that share the database as well as like this sort of like step to get them away from the monolithic database. And some of those actually got off of it. Some of those aren't. But it was very intentional to try to not go too fast because we knew it would be complicated to manage. Okay. So I don't know, probably maybe a couple of years after I started was when we started really getting into it. Okay. So the shared database thing like works pretty well.
Man, this will be interesting. I'm scheduled to talk with somebody from Shopify in a couple of weeks for an interview for this show. And they have theirs all in a monolith. So that'll be interesting to hear the differences between the two.
I would love to because, I mean, you know, I think, I don't know, DHH was tweeting something about this. And I get the gist of what he's saying, right? It's like you have to be disciplined. You have to make your code, you have to like write good code to make the monolith work. And if you do that, you can. But clearly lots of us are very smart, good developers. And we have screwed up the monolith many times. So I'm curious like how to make that work. Like we had a few developers from GitHub at Stitch Fix and GitHub is a monolith and they didn't have the same horror stories I had from Living Social. So they must have some way to like make it work. And I would love to know more than just, you know, be a good programmer.
Well, let me ask you this. Now I'm getting really curious. I was interested that Stitch Fix was a non-monolith right from the very beginning. And that made me wonder, well, what led you to start off like that? And it sounds like maybe you had some experiences with a Living Social code base that made you not want to start with a monolith next time.
Yeah. And another developer who was at ModCloth had the same thing. And so we were like, we're never doing that again.
Okay.
And so it was basically like the app was massive. There's a lot of people in there. So it was lots of churn. The test suite was very difficult to run. You would never be able to run the whole test suite. And there was just tons of patterns. So like one of the test files, it had three different test frameworks in the same test file. One of which I added like an idiot, right? So like it just sort of bred this sort of real mess because it just wasn't managed or those standards, like how to do this, like those just didn't exist.
Hang on, let me interrupt you there, and because I want to zoom in on this because this is maybe kind of important. I had a similar experience at the last place I worked. We had decent test coverage on our Rails application, but then we had an Ember application that had no tests. We all agreed that we wanted tests on the Ember application, but we didn't come to an agreement as to how. And so we ended up with two separate test suites for the Ember application. And I don't think everybody was even aware of the existence of both of them. And maybe some people didn't even know about either. And so it was like, it was almost a complete waste of time to even have these because they weren't part of the whole test and deployment pipeline. They were just kind of there.
Yeah. I mean, it's bad because it spins cycles, it wastes time, and all of that. And so, you know, then doing an upgrade, I mean, there was a whole team at Living Social whose job was to upgrade from Ruby 1.8 to 1.9. And that's really hard to do. So you need good developers doing that, developers who probably should be doing more business impactful things, but there's no other way to do it than get them to do this upgrade and spend, you know, 3 months on it. And so then it's like, okay, what is the advantage, right? Like, I know that microservices is hard, but, and I know the advantages of the monolith, but like, could we get those by doing it another way? And
oh wait, yeah. Sorry. Before we go back to that, I do want to ask about the test suites. How did you get there? Like, was that just like a lack of communication, or what was that?
How did they get to the sort of like three test frameworks in one thing? It was just no one. I'm sure you've worked with developers who are like, they see that everything is done a certain way and it's not their way. And they're like, I want to do it my way. And mm-hmm. they don't care about the consistency because they think their way is better. So, you know, there's a lot of people like that. And I have feelings about that, about certain things we all do. And so they just did it their way and no one stopped them. So someone was like, I don't like test unit. I like RSpec. So I'm just going to start writing RSpec tests in this app. And that just got merged and there was no one managing it. No one saying, don't do that. Then of course, when you see two things, that breeds more things, right? And like I said, I introduced my own like stupid test library to some of the things because I figured that's the way we do things here. And it's, just, you know, not good.
Yeah. Yeah. That reminds me of that thing about like a society that tolerates everything, including intolerance, will eventually become like a dictatorship or whatever.
Right.
Because, Yeah. So those things have to be, it's almost better to have like consistent shittiness than to have some stuff be bad and then introduce something that's good and have everything be inconsistent.
Yeah. And that is a hard thing to do as teams get bigger, is like, cause you don't want to be stuck with, we always do it that way. You want to be able to innovate and evolve, but you can't just have it be an explosion of the Wild West. Right. So you have to have a clear way of like, we're going from this to this, and this is the old thing, don't do it this way. This is the new thing, do it this way. And it requires a lot of sort of careful management.
Those kind of changes are really challenging because you have a change. If you have a change that's so big that you don't want to do it all at once because it would be too risky to implement it all at once, then you have to implement it in little pieces. But that means that you have to have the like care and attentiveness and communication to maintain that project over a long period of time so that it actually gets completed and doesn't just start. I've seen this. I've done this just like as a solo developer where you like start moving in one direction and then you like have a priority shift and that just gets left behind. And now you have like this permanent inconsistency.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that's sort of like another thing that I have observed a lot is like the whole, oh, we'll make technical debt and clean it up later. Like that doesn't really happen. Like it's really hard to justify.
Works.
So like, don't make a mess just to go slightly faster. Right. Like, but that's, what is a mess? What is not a mess? I mean, that's hard to know too.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like I know a mess when I see one. You know it's a mess because it's really painful to work with the code.
Yeah. Well, there's also this notion of like doing it right is a lot of developers' version of do it right is like actually over-engineering. And, you know, I've done it a million times, right? Like it's a very like mid-level developer thing to do. And stopping that is hard. Like don't just engineer it well, but just for the problem that we have. Don't over-engineer it. That's another thing. But if you can get that right, then it helps and you don't have messes to go back and clean up.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I want to make the distinction that like doing things the right way is called the right way because it's actually better. And I feel like a lot of people, especially maybe non-technical managers, or I should be more fair and say unsophisticated non-technical managers, don't understand that fact that it's called the right way because it's better. And we say it's better because it's faster and easier to maintain the code.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's like thinking about the carrying costs, right? It's like, I mean, a lot of developers will give a non-technical decision maker the option. I can do it without tests faster. And of course they're going to say, I don't care about tests. Yeah. Do it faster. But that's a carrying cost. And that's a long-term problem. And so the developer is the only one that knows that. And so they should be saying, look, the carrying cost of no test is too high. I'm not doing it without tests. I'm writing tests. That's not even an option.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you said that because it's a very common like belief or whatever. And it sounds good on the surface. If you don't think about it at all, it's like, okay, boss, I can do this thing that you want done in 3 weeks. We have two options. I can get it done in 3 weeks if we cut some certain corners. Or if I do it the right way, I can get it done in 6 weeks and then we won't hit the deadline. And the boss is always going to go for the three-week version.
Yeah, exactly.
And they'll pick that over and over and over again until you get to the point where you can't accomplish anything anymore because everything is such garbage. So you, as the professional, need to take responsibility and like draw a line and say, things on this side of this line are my responsibility and my decision, and I can't abdicate those parts of my responsibility to my boss or anybody else. Yeah. And obviously, like, that's not just to say that you should like simplistically always code in a certain way that's slower and never make those trade-offs, because there are realities. But I think people err too much on the side of cutting corners and not enough on the side of fighting for doing things a better way.
Yeah, and it's like cutting scope is better than cutting corners, but you got to say what scope is relevant to cut, and you know that's an easier decision for people to make. But yeah, it's hard.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying now to remember what we were talking about before I took us down this side trail. I think we were talking about those three different test suites.
Yeah.
And before that, we were talking about something else. Do you remember?
How do we avoid the monolith?
And the ways that you got burned by the monolith. Yeah, yeah. Continue on that. What else with that?
Yeah. So it was, you know, it was very hard. So like, you know, the more code, it was just a ton of code. So it was hard to know how everything was going to interact, because there's so many ways that the code can interact, and you can't possibly understand the whole code base. So like, it was very hard to know if a change you were going to make, like, what was that going to do? Especially since everything was in an active record. If I change this thing, what's going to happen on some screen I've never heard of? So you would deploy, and then you would watch your email to see if the number of errors increased. Like, there's always errors, but if the number of errors increased coincident with your deploy, then you would think maybe something got broken, and then you would go try to figure out what that was. And it just seemed like a waste of time and not a good way.
This is in the monolith. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm sure that it could have been factored better, but it just wasn't. So like, so then if you compare that to like what Stitch Fix did with lots of different apps sharing the database, well, if it's like the line at Trader Joe's, right? If one of those apps was a horrible disaster zone, it's all contained in that one app. The rest of the apps are fine, and that distinction is important, I think, because
line at Trader Joe's. What is that comparison?
So like at Trader Joe's, there's one line, and you get the next checker. So that if one person who's like stopping at Trader Joe's is really slow with the checker, they don't hold up the rest of the line. They just hold up that checker. I don't know. Maybe this analogy wasn't right.
So great. Yeah, that's the proper way to do lines.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad they do it that way. I don't shop at Trader Joe's because it's a geographical impossibility, but that's a good way to do it.
Yeah. So then also, like, you know, Stitch Fix, we have different teams, and teams have different responsibilities. And so the apps and the teams line up. So if team one is just making a mess in their application, well, team two can decide to be more disciplined to make their application cleaner, and you've at least got some separation and some way to manage that stuff. Or, you know, more realistically, it's like, well, we want to do things this way and the other team wants to do it another way. Cool. You're in separate code bases, so it's not as painful.
Working with microservices obviously has costs.
Yeah.
And I would be of the opinion, I've never worked with microservices ever, but I would be of the opinion that it's going to be premature to get to that place of where the benefits of having microservices pays off and outweighs the costs of having the microservices. But you, of course, started off from the very beginning with microservices. Was there kind of a period of like, where that equation was upside down for a while, but you decided it was worth it for the long term? Or like, how did that part of it go?
Well, I should be clear. We didn't start off with microservices so much as different full stack apps sharing the same database. So for example, like stitchfix.com has an app and the warehouse has an app, and they don't talk to each other directly at all. Like they only talk through the database. So they're basically just like a regular Rails app that just happens to have its database being accessed by another application. And so we did that pattern for quite a while. So,
and you only had two different applications?
Well, eventually we had more. So there was, you know, each sort of user-facing function had one. So their stylist had one, the merchandisers had one, customer service agents had one, and there was
another
one.
Okay, but it wasn't like from day one you had 30 of them.
No. We just created them as needed and evolved them over time. And then at a certain point, it made sense to actually extract certain things into microservices where like two apps by two different teams need access to some data or logic, and there's no other way that they can share that other than copying code. So, okay, we'll make a microservice to do that.
Okay. Yeah, I was secretly thinking to myself over here, Dave is crazy for starting off with this microservice architecture. But if you only had two apps in the beginning, that seems that seems pretty reasonable.
Yeah, and it was always like every app is owned entirely by one team. So there was no like everybody owns this app kind of concept. I mean, there's a few apps like that, and they were not well cared for, as you could imagine. But most apps were like, this is this team's responsibility, and no other team is going to come in here and, you know, do whatever they want in your app because it's for your function, basically.
Did you have any challenges with sharing the same databases? Because I worked on an application some years ago where there was a WordPress application and then a PHP Symfony application that I built. They both used the same database. And we had these issues. I was actually describing this technical scenario to somebody a few weeks ago, and they're like, well, what's so bad about that? And I'm like, well, it's kind of like you come home from work and you were going to make spaghetti for dinner, and then you discover your roommate used all the spaghetti noodles and now you can't make dinner. You know, like things would happen in the database from the other application that were like surprising and mysterious and all that kind of stuff. Did you run into that or any of that or not so much?
We did a little bit. So we used Postgres and we used foreign key constraints and check constraints a lot. So that limited the damage an app could do by making bad data in the database. We also had a separate Rails app that was just the database migrations for that shared database that had no code in it. And so that was like, if you made a PR to that thing, all eyes were going to be on that to make sure that everybody understood. And the Active Records, of course, didn't have any real code in them, so they could be pretty easily shared. But then, you get into all these weird contentious things like, okay, I'm writing to the shipment record and this other app is reading from the shipment record, but there's a database lock. And what happens when these things are locked? All kinds of bad things. And do we even know that's happening? So there is definitely stuff like that. And we had to basically say at some point, no new connections to the database are allowed. Whoever's using it now, they get it. No one else can have access to it anymore because it was causing problems. I think we were Heroku's biggest Postgres customer for a while. How we solved this problem. It's like, just keep making a bigger and bigger Postgres. But eventually, like that, right, you can only get so big. So we had to solve it in other ways. But
okay.
Yeah. But like bad data-wise, constraints like kind of kept us from having a lot of bad data in the database. So.
Well, there's about a million more questions I want to ask you, Dave, but we're running toward the end of our time. So I'll ask you maybe one more question before I ask you the standard question of where people can find you and all that kind of stuff.
Cool.
I want to ask more of like a career-oriented question, which is like, how did you find yourself in the position of being one of the very first developers at this, what I assume at the time was like a new startup of Stitch Fix? How did that come about?
Yeah, I was very lucky. So my boss at a previous company, the one where we had the Java monolith, he had left that company, moved to San Francisco, navigated the startup circuit, and basically got connected with Katrina Lake, who's the founder of Stitch Fix. And so he was hired as the CTO. So Katrina had hired some contractors, realized that that's not how to build a good business, and hired this guy, Jeff, to be the CTO and build up the engineering team. And so Jeff was like, dude, you got to come work at this thing. And I was like, it's women's clothes. What do I know about women's clothes, right? But he sort of convinced me that it was a good opportunity, a good place to work, interesting problems to solve. And that I could do it without having to move to San Francisco. They were willing to do remote. So, so I knew someone from the previous job is the short answer. Like, I feel very, very fortunate that he thought of me and that I didn't screw up that opportunity.
Yeah, that's great. There can definitely be advantages to being early on. Like the position I'm in right now, my now boss found me based on a blog post I wrote, and I did what was supposed to be a weekend project for him. And long story short, it turned into permanent employment. And so that's great. It's also possible to be early on and like nothing great ever comes of that. But sometimes it works out great, as in this current case.
Yeah, totally. I'm very glad.
Yeah. Okay. And what are you up to now?
Yeah. So I left in May. I've been doing some, you know, consulting, advising, and actually trying to find another early stage startup to work for. And since I experience a pretty positive experience, it's making me very choosy and taking a long time doing that. And the thing is, like, all the technical stuff, it's interesting, but it's really like building up trust with the people that you're working with is actually way more important than where you put your active record, logic. And so figuring out that from like hour long conversations is pretty difficult. So I'm, you know, taking things very slowly and fortunate enough that I have the time to be able to do that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. The hiring process is kind of crazy in the sense that it's like going on maybe one or two dates with somebody and then deciding whether you want to get married.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly. So.
Okay. So final question for you, Dave, where can people find you online and find out more about your upcoming book and all that stuff?
Yeah. So I go by DaveTron5000 on Twitter, DaveTron 500. And from there you can find links to my blog and all that good stuff. But the book is at sustainable-rails.com. It's about a third of the way done. I'll be doing a beta release, selling it in progress. So that'll be happening in the next couple weeks, I hope. So that's where to find me.
Well, Dave, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.